Chapter 18 The Palace of the Minotaur. It was 1894. The antiques dealers in the Athens city market knew the Englishman well, a short, aggressive man who spoke fluent Greek. He would arrive every morning and walk slowly from stall to stall, sorting through small trays of jewels and seals. Sometimes he would pick up a tiny seal and peer at the almost invisible script in the sunlight. The dealers found him a tough customer. He would haggle and haggle, sometimes walking away until the price was right. As he wrapped his purchases in paper and slipped them into his leather shoulder bag, he would ask questions. Where did the seals come from? Which site yielded the seals? The answer was always Crete. Arthur John Evans, 1851 to 1941, is the only archaeologist ever to discover a civilization thanks to his eyesight. He could read even the tiniest letters without spectacles or a magnifying glass. Like a terrier, Evans followed the archaeological scent to Crete in 1894. The island's major city, Heraklion, was a treasure trove of Cretan gems and seals. Most came from an olive tree-covered hillside named Knossos. Evans combed the Knossos hillside for hours, collecting artifacts and copying exotic marks on potsherds. A stone vessel from Knossos was identical to those from Mycenae, and so there was clearly a connection between the two. Without further ado, Evans decided to buy Knossos. He was not the first archaeologist to try. Heinrich Schliemann had done so, believing it to be the palace of the legendary King Minos. But whereas Schliemann had failed, Evans succeeded, although it took him 2 years of bargaining. As Evans was to discover, Knossos was indeed the major palace on Crete, and perhaps the home of legendary King Minos, if he ever existed. Evans had no interest in speculation about Minos, and nor did he believe Schliemann's claims about Troy and Mycenae. See Chapter 15. He was no self-taught archaeologist out for sensational discoveries, but rather a scholar in search of reliable information. Arthur Evans had been plunged into archaeology from childhood. He was the son of Sir John Evans, a wealthy English papermaker. Sir John had supported Boucher de Perth's claims in the Somme Valley, see Chapter 7, and was an expert on ancient stone tools, as well as on Greek and Roman coins. Encouraged by his father, Arthur was drawing coins by the age of 7, and 3 years later he started accompanying John on archaeological trips. As a student, Arthur was always restless, complaining that his Oxford University lecturers were dull. He spent his summers wandering through Europe on foot and fell in love with the people of its southeast in the Balkans. Known locally as the Mad Englishman, Evans dabbled in journalism and reported on political unrest in the Austrian Empire so effectively that he was jailed for 6 weeks. The authorities expelled him from the empire, and he returned to England in search of a career. For all his political reporting, Evans was devoted to archaeology. He spent every spare moment collecting artifacts of every kind. He had inherited his instinct for style from his father, and he acquired an encyclopedic knowledge of archaeology. In 1884, he became keeper of Oxford's Ashmolean Museum, a post he held for 25 years. This was a neglected institution, but the new keeper reorganized the displays and acquired numerous artifacts. He spent most of his time in the Mediterranean, however, collecting and making geological investigations. His assistant would inform visitors that the keeper was in Bohemia. The university did not seem to mind, perhaps because he was less of a nuisance when he was absent. No one knows when Evans first became aware of Crete. His research started with objects from Mycenae on the Greek mainland. This was such an important trading center around 1350 BC that artifacts had arrived there from all over Greece and the Aegean. As he examined the hundreds of minute seals and engraved gemstones, Evans realized that the Mycenaeans had their own writing. Symbols like those scratched on Mycenaean pots came from as far afield as Egypt. The search for the unknown script brought Evans to the Athens market, and from there to Crete. While waiting to close the Knossos deal, Evans had explored the length and breadth of Crete on a mule. He had found seals like those at Mycenae for sale even in tiny village markets, and realized that there were at least two writing systems that had belonged to the great civilization that lay under his feet at Knossos. In fact, there were four. The palace became his property just as the Cretans rebelled against their Turkish masters. Evans helped the rebels, providing food and medicine at his own expense. The victorious Prince George, the new ruler of Crete, was so grateful to him that an excavation permit for Knossos arrived within a few months. The excavations began in March 1900. Evans knew a great deal about artifacts and archaeology, but his digging experience amounted to little more than a few small excavations. Now, he was to tackle a palace. Fortunately, he had the sense to hire an excavation assistant, a Scot named Duncan Mackenzie, who was to work on Knossos for more than 30 years. Mackenzie managed the workers in fluent Greek with a Scots accent. Evans decided where to dig, examined every find, and kept detailed notes. He also engaged architect Theodore Fife to prepare drawings. Unlike Schliemann's digs, this was a carefully planned excavation from the start. On the second day, Evans found himself gazing at a house with faded wall paintings. The site became a maze of rooms, passages, and foundations. There was nothing Greek or Roman about Knossos, which was clearly earlier than Mycenae. Soon the workforce numbered 100 men, all clearing the palace rooms. Thousands of artifacts emerged from the foundations. Great storage jars, hundreds of small cups, and even a complex drainage system came to light. Best of all, Evans had dozens of clay tablets with writing to test his microscopic vision. In April 1900, a magnificent wall painting of a cupbearer with flowing locks and a wasp waist emerged from the soil. Mackenzie carefully backed it with plaster for removal to the Heraclion Museum. Joyfully, Evans announced the discovery of the ancient Minoan civilization of Crete, although King Minos and Theseus were but myths. The Knossos excavations soon covered 1 hectare. In April 1900, the men unearthed a room where there was still a ceremonial bath, together with a stone throne. Stone benches lined the walls, with fine paintings of wingless griffins behind them. This may have been where a priestess appeared, representing the mother goddess, who was believed to oversee the land. Evans sent for Emile Gilleron, a Swiss artist who had long experience of ancient inscriptions. The two men pieced together the Knossos wall paintings. There were olives in flower, a young boy gathering saffron, a spice collected from crocus flowers, and solemn processions on the march. A great painted plaster relief of a charging bull haunted Evans's mind. Bulls appeared everywhere, in frescoes, on vases, on gems, as figurines. He was beginning to form a picture of a long-vanished civilization. Evans began each morning by checking the previous day's work. Page after page in his tiny handwriting documented every layer, every find, and every room. Day after day, the palace became ever more complex. It was an extraordinary structure. You entered the great central courtyard through a large pillared hall. Rows of narrow storage rooms lay west of the courtyard, each opening onto a narrow passageway. Many had been lined with lead to house valuables as well as huge grain stocks. Evans estimated that nearly 100,000 liters of olive oil were once stored at Knossos. Two imposing stairways led to a second story of staterooms above the shrines. A western palace entrance led through a paved courtyard past huge pictures of young men leaping over bulls. It took Evans and Mackenzie months to decipher the royal chambers with their plastered walls, within which remains of wooden thrones were found. Knossos was far more than a palace. It was a commercial and religious center, and a workshop where craftspeople fashioned everything from pots to metal objects and stone vessels. Knossos absorbed the rest of Evans's life. When he inherited great wealth, he embarked on a partial and somewhat imaginative reconstruction of some of the buildings to give visitors an impression of the palace. Unfortunately, his reconstructions used concrete, which is impossible to remove without damaging original structures. He was gambling with the past. Any form of archaeological reconstruction is difficult to carry out successfully. How can you be sure that the buildings looked the way you think they did? What was the purpose of each room? What were the different levels of the palace used for? Evans and Githeron wrestled with a set of buildings that were a maze when in use, and even more of one after excavation. On a recent visit, I quickly became confused, and I came to realize why Greek legends refer to a labyrinth. Knossos was not a well-planned structure. Evans and Githeron had a somewhat romantic vision of the Minoans. They thought of the civilization as colorful, carefree, and peaceful. The archaeologist and the architect produced their reconstruction using concrete pillars to replace wooden columns. Thanks to draftsman Theodore Fife's accurate drawings, the workers rebuilt walls and the great stairway at the heart of the palace, even as excavations continued. Evans spent much time painstakingly restoring the wall paintings from small fragments in the trenches, like a huge jigsaw puzzle. You get a somewhat romantic impression of the Minoans, and undoubtedly Evans added imaginary details to scenes like the bull dance. In one case, he even reconstructed a single king-like figure instead of the three people preserved in the fragments. These were the mistakes of a man obsessed with Minoan civilization. Between 1900 and 1935, Arthur Evans commuted between Knossos and Oxford. He built himself a villa on site where he studied the vast collections of pottery from the excavations. His expertise with artifacts enabled him to identify occasional Egyptian finds that he matched with vessels from the Nile. In addition, English Egyptologist Flinders Petrie had unearthed Mycenaean pottery near Memphis that he dated to between 1500 and 1200 BC. See Chapter 17. Using Petrie's findings to cross-date, the technique used by Oscar Montilius, Evans dated the beginnings of Minoan civilization to about 3000 BC. It was at the height of its power between 2000 and 1250 BC. But invading Mycenaeans from the mainland finally destroyed the palace. Years of work produced a magnificent narrative of Minoan civilization, presented in full in The Palace of Minos, published between 1921 and 1935. In this masterwork, Evans put the palace at the center of a chronological survey of Minoan civilization. Stage by stage, he built up his story. In the final volume, he bade farewell to his beloved Knossos. He had but one regret. He had failed to decipher the four scripts that emerged from the excavations. Arthur Evans may have been a romantic who tended to dwell on the positive aspects of Minoan life. But we are fortunate that this remarkable archaeologist with microscopic eyesight had the sense to rely on skilled experts. Nevertheless, the vision of the Minoans and of Knossos was all his. Every time I visit Knossos, I look around in awe at what Arthur Evans achieved. New excavations, deciphered scripts, and radiocarbon dating have, of course, modified his portrait of an almost forgotten civilization. Today, we know more about the lesser Minoan palaces and can imagine some of the complex political and social relationships that lay below the colorful surface. Few archaeologists describe a civilization from scratch, without written records, almost single-handed, and to a high scientific standard. But Arthur Evans did just that. He died in 1941 at the age of 90. By that time, archaeology had changed beyond all recognition.